Well, good morning. I'm delighted to see you. Thank you for coming. I have to express my appreciation and joy to the opportunity to be in the assembly this morning. You say, well, what's different about it from every other assembly? I don't know that there is a measured difference, but I really enjoyed the worship that I was able to do, and it reminded me of the need for planned and thoughtful leadership in our assembly. I want to express my appreciation to all the men who led us this morning. Andy came to me right before and said, do you have a passage to read? And I thought, and I said, no, I think you should pick one. And Andy, you couldn't have picked a better one. It reminded us from 2 Corinthians 7:1. It reminded me of what it is that we're here to do. We're here to give appreciation and praise to God for the fact that we are His privileged children because of His promises to us that we've been reminded of to be His children. What do we do? We cleanse ourselves from all defilements of both flesh and spirit in the fear of God. We have to be reminded of that. And I enjoyed being in the assembly this morning with all of you. Well, I want to start with an amphora. You know what an amphora is? It's a big container where they stored grains and water and wine and oil, all kinds of things in the biblical time. I picked the prettiest one I could find. I don't know that it certainly is not, doesn't look like it's an ancient one, but it represents what they stored things in. I want to talk to you this morning about what the Bible says about drinking alcohol. And so let's begin by thinking about that. There are three categories of Christians, I believe, as we think about the drinking of alcohol. And we have to say up front that not all Christians are agreed on what they should do and what others should do in regard to alcohol. One category of Christian is that they are totally abstinent and conscientiously opposed to all drinking by anyone. Another category is they're totally abstinent, just like the first, in practice, but not conscientiously opposed to all drinking by anyone. And thirdly, there are those that are not totally abstinent, but opposed to drunkenness. Now, I believe those are the three major categories among Christians. There may be others, but you're free, of course, to come to me and describe what another category might be. Well, maybe it would be helpful for me to tell you a little bit about my background. Where do I come and how do I come to this issue? This will reveal my biases and my ways of thinking and come to a thought. I was born into a family with a father and a mother who were totally abstinent and who taught us to be so as well. My father came from the Methodist tradition. My mother came from the Church of Christ. Many people do not remember that Methodism was strongly associated with the temperance movement of this country in the late 1800s and into the 1900s that progressed to the point that they were able, through their efforts and the efforts of others, to pass a constitutional amendment. A constitutional amendment that said that the production of alcohol and the sale of alcohol was illegal in this country. It's hard to believe now, these so many years afterward, isn't it? But that's the way it was. That was the climate. I remember that I also grew up in a town that was dry. Now, you young people have no idea what that means. It doesn't mean that we ran out of water. We had plenty of water. A dry town was that there was no public sale and public consumption of alcohol. How different it is today. And I also remember and experienced more than one wet, dry election. This is something citizens voted to have. Wet, dry elections accompanied by preaching and canvassing by religious neighbors and friends where we participated in campaigning for that election. We were on the dry side and we campaigned for that. Methodist, Baptist, Assembly of God, Church of Christ, Christian Church, Presbyterians, and others all joined together to promote and keep our dry code in our town. We worked to keep the town dry. It seemed there was at least one issue that united most religious people, not all. Roman Catholics and Episcopalians generally did not participate on our side of this issue. We were against the selling and consumption of alcoholic drinks. Of course, there were jokes about the closet Church of Christ and Baptist folk who were drinking in their homes and in the closets as they campaigned to keep it dry. I understand. And I was, of course, heard those jokes. Eventually, the tide of popular opinion changed, and gradually, the consensus was lost, and the town voted to allow the sale and public consumption of liquor in full force. It gradually became that way. Now, my hometown is no different from any other town in America, with the full panoply of alcoholic drinks able to be bought and consumed by the public. Except for about a 4-year period during college, I have practiced total abstinence my whole life. Even when I did drink alcohol, I did not do it with a clear conscience. Now, young people, that isn't right. I'm not promoting that. That wasn't right. I'm just telling you the truth. I didn't do it with a clear conscience, except on a few occasions for medicinal purposes. Most of my close friends and associates also have practiced total abstinence. Therefore, for most of my life, I have enjoyed, from my standpoint, the freedom from any thought of addiction to alcohol, of being drunk, driving drunk, or any of the abuses that have become so common in our culture. I've enjoyed that freedom. I rarely think about it, except how may I help someone else to possibly overcome something in their life that I see is destroying them. Since I have no taste for alcohol, honestly, it just tastes horrible to me. I don't like the taste of it. Never have, really. This is a potential temptation that has no appeal to me. Now, folks, I'm just trying to give you the facts. These are personal facts from my standpoint. Since there are so many wonderful drinks readily available, particularly water with lime being the chief among them right now in my taste, it is somewhat challenging for me to understand why anyone would want to drink, especially in our alcohol-saturated culture with all the problems that go with it. I face that challenge. I accept it, that I have to understand and think through another person's lifestyle and what they think about. But I want to tell you that that's challenging for me. But why would you want to do it? I can heartily recommend my practice to everyone, and I do recommend it to everyone. Why wouldn't I? Especially to the young before whom I believe it is my responsibility to serve as an example. Example of what? Of a full, complete life lived without any alcohol. I believe that's almost totally contrary to a lot of the advertising that we get. You just can't be a full, have a full lived life unless you're partaking of some alcohol in some way. I don't believe that's so, and I don't believe you believe it's so. But someone asks, are there not other faithful Christians, no less devoted than you, who are not totally abstinent? To which I say, yes, I believe there are. I know them. They too have come to their practice from their upbringing and culture. But we have to admit, what difference does it make about our upbringing and our different cultures in regard to deciding what's right and what's wrong? In other words, how should we approach this diversity of belief and practice? Not strictly from what we have grown up to believe, although an understanding of our various journeys will help us to be patient and understanding of others. We should decide what we should do the same way we decide all other spiritual, moral, and ethical questions. What does the Bible teach? What does the Bible teach? You could travel around this globe and find all kinds of backgrounds. What does the Bible teach about this subject? Now, I'm not going to try to tell you everything I think the Bible teaches about this subject in this lesson, so everybody relax. It teaches a lot in many different ways. And I'm only going to try to pursue one segment of it today. There'll be occasions to do other things at other times. And I want to encourage you. If I say something this morning that you disagree with or you think is overstated or understated, come to me. We'll sit down and we'll talk. And further, I want to make the commitment to you that if in the course of our thinking about this or in my future life, if I come to believe differently than what I'm telling you this morning, I will come into this pulpit and recant whatever I've said in the past that I now think is wrong. I believe I have the responsibility to keep an open mind, as we all do. What does the Bible teach? To my knowledge, there is no "do not drink alcohol" in the Bible. If there were, I would imagine there wouldn't be as much controversy as there is. There'd still be some. I mean, we have clear statements in the scriptures that people disagree with and don't want to accept. Now, I caution you, don't check out right now. Okay, that settles it for me. Stay with me. But let's just say right off, there isn't a "do not drink alcohol." Further, let's consider all the evidence. We got to look at all of it. We're not going to look at all of it today, just some of it. But let's consider all the evidence. This is like many other Bible questions that we get. We ought to look at everything that God has revealed and try to make our decision. So in other words, let's draw conclusions based on the preponderance of the evidence and then act upon it. Now, I realize that this requires more effort. This does. Some find this disquieting and maybe even unwilling to put in the time and the effort to look at all the evidence. Others may want the local church to decide for them what they're going to do. That's not my goal this morning. My goal is not to make your decision for you. My goal is to try to present as best I can, as objectively as I can. I've already given you my background of my biases. So it's right there. It's right before you. But I am striving in my study to present what I believe is objective truth. All the evidence. And I realize that being objective is a challenge. It's a challenge for you. It's a challenge for me. So let's try to put aside our background to the degree we can. And I may say things this morning that you have never thought of in that light. It may be something that you say, well, I just can't be right. Well, think about it. All I ask you to do is think about it. Examine it yourself. And ultimately, of course, you've got to make your own decision. I have to make mine. All right? What are the parameters? If there's no just simple, direct statement, don't do it, or do it, what are the parameters? What are the boundaries within which we will make our decision? Well, first of all, there are positive ones where drinking wine is permitted and you might even say is recommended. It's one parameter. Call that the positive one. And then there is the negative where drinking wine is condemned. You say, well, why doesn't the Bible get it right? This is one of the difficulties in studying this issue. You can read some passages that to the average reader, that's all of us, just reading the Bible without learning Greek or Hebrew or going back into the commentaries or whatever, just reading the scriptures, you'd say, well, that seems to be a statement where wine is presented in a positive light. On the other hand, there are passages where it is presented in a negative light. To some degree, this is partly responsible for the controversy, you see. We've got to look at all of the evidence and what our parameters are. Well, let's develop this thought a little bit more. Let's start with the positive. Drinking wine permitted, you could even say in one case, recommended. First passage. No longer, Paul tells Timothy, drink water exclusively, but use a little wine for the sake of your stomach and your frequent ailments. Now, some commentators that I've read say, well, that's just, we shouldn't even consider that because that's medicinal. Well, of course, it is medicinal. But it's still taking alcohol into your body. It's regarded here as positive. But I want to observe something. No longer drink water exclusively. So what was Timothy doing? Drinking water exclusively. I wonder why. I wonder why a boy raised by a Greek father and a Jewish mother in a culture where the drinking of wine was common would only be drinking water. Now, ultimately, I can't answer that. But it suggests here that possibly, maybe even probably, he was drinking water only because he saw the problems with wine and he decided to be totally abstinent. But he was suffering apparently from contaminated water. It had bugs in it. And so Paul says, Timothy, it's okay. In fact, he recommends, here's what you need to do. Put a little wine in that water. It'd kill those bugs so that you can function better. Well, wouldn't we all agree that's a positive light upon what the purposes that wine served? Medicinally, as a disinfectant. Well, but there are others. Ecclesiastes 9, verse 7. Go then, eat your bread in happiness and drink your wine with a cheerful heart, for God has already approved your works. Now, those of you who've studied a little bit more, you say, well, is that wine there, grape juice, or fermented? In a later lesson, I'm going to get in all the various words that deal with this issue. We are somewhat handicapped in English in that we have translated the Hebrew basically three words, and the Greek one word. We have used our one word wine to include both unfermented grape juice and wine. But putting that aside, a common reader reading that, what would you say about the light in which wine is placed here? Well, it's positive. It's something here, a cheerful heart, for God has already approved your words. All right, another. This one from Deuteronomy 14, verse 26. He's speaking to those who are Jews who could lived far away, if they wanted to pay the tithe or give the tithe to come to Jerusalem to pay it. Well, they would sell their property and turn it into cash. He'd come to Jerusalem and then buy these things. And look what he says. You may spend the money, the tithe money, for whatever your heart desires, for oxen or sheep or wine or strong drink or whatever your heart desires. And there you shall eat in the presence of the Lord your God and rejoice, you in your household. Now, I realize that there's controversy about what all this means, and we'll get into that in a later lesson. But here again, there are statements in Scripture that put the drinking of wine in a positive light. But then what about the negative? Certainly there are passages that deal with it from a negative perspective. Drinking wine is condemned in some passages. For the time already past is sufficient, Peter writes, for you to have carried out the desire of the Gentiles, having pursued a course of sensuality, lust, drunkenness, carousing, drinking parties, and abominable idolatries. First word that hits our topic is drunkenness. This, apparently, from my study of this word, is just the fall down drunk. The person who is completely inebriated, and the drunk and even the perpetual drunk. But the next word, the carousing. Well, I wanted to make this point about this word that's here translated drunkenness. It's a combination of two words. It's wine plus excess, an overflow or surplus of wine, drunkenness. Then the next word is the word carousing. It's revelings in the King James Bible, or merrymaking in other versions, even orgies. It literally comes with just letting loose. We see that in our culture. Often alcohol is associated with just letting loose. Having a cheerful party where you don't worry about outcomes or whatever. You're just in the moment. Seen the commercial where the guy's got a big six-pack under his arm, gets out of his car to go into the party, stops, turns around, pulls out his knife, punctures his tire. What's the message? Doesn't want to even think about having to drive home because he wants to enjoy the party. These types of revelries are carousing that is associated with alcohol. But then there's another term, drinking parties. King James Bible says banqueting. Well, that doesn't quite do it in our culture because we go to all kinds of banquets. At least I have, and I know you have. The banqueting of the Greek world was a partying atmosphere where the alcohol flowed. Now, it's interesting, though, many commentators and scholars tell us it does not necessarily imply drinking to excess. It differs from drunkenness. It's It's related to words of excess in that it gives opportunity for excess. So we're talking about, if you will, the culture of drinking in drinking parties. Possibly the cocktail hour where we all get together and all the boys get together to have their drinking together. It's in the category of abominable idolatries. And then another passage, more direct, and do not get drunk with wine. Obviously, he's talking about alcoholic wine. For that is dissipation, but be filled with the Spirit. See the contrast? And I almost tripped over this wire. It would be a reminiscent of Fonny Beard if I had tripped and fell. Almost. Look at the contrast. Don't get drunk with wine. Be filled with Spirit. Now, obviously, we're talking about two different approaches to life that we have to recognize and make a decision about. And then, look at the Proverbs. Proverbs are a collection of wisdom literature. Wine is a mocker, strong drink a brawler. And whoever is intoxicated by it is not wise. Another, do not be with heavy drinkers of wine or with gluttonous eaters of meat. For the heavy drinker and the glutton will come to poverty, and drowsiness will clothe one with rags. Somewhat of a differing slant here. It's from the standpoint of the drinker. The heavy drinker is going to be lazy and not energetic and not be able to take care of themselves along with the glutton. Another, who has woe? Who has sorrow? Who has contentions? Who has complaining? Who has wounds without cause? Who has redness of eyes? Those who linger long over wine. He's warning us. Those who get to taste mixed wine. Do not look on the wine when it is red, when it sparkles in the cup. Oh, it looks good. It looks so good, refreshing. Maybe get a little relief from my worldly frustrations and relax when it goes down smoothly. At the last, it bites like a serpent. It stings like a viper. Your eyes will see strange things, and your mind will utter perverse things. That's the problem with the alcohol. Drinking of alcohol is its effect on the mind. Further, and you will be like one who lies down in the middle of the sea. Oh, now the room's beginning to spin. Or like one who lies down on the top of a mast, you know, of a ship. They struck me, but I did not become ill. They beat me, but I did not know it. Here the person is being hit and struck. He done, he's so drunk, he doesn't even know it. When shall I awake? I will seek another drink. Now, later we'll talk about our culture and the evidence from our culture that suggests that sometimes we don't do ourselves a favor if we do not see this immense problem in our culture with alcohol, the drinking of alcohol. Well, but now we go to the use of wine in the Bible. Now, the point of this section is, how was it used in Bible times? How are we to think about it? In other words, when we read the scriptures, you see the word wine, what we're asking is, or reminding ourselves, that none of the Bible was written to us. Sometimes we forget that. It wasn't written in our culture. It was written 2,000 years ago in another culture. But all of the Bible was written for us. Well, how do we bridge the gap that all of the Bible was written for us, but none directly to us? Well, we must understand, what did the Bible mean to the Bible people, to the people to whom it was addressed? How did the Corinthians understand the statements of Paul How did the others of the New Testament and Old Testament in the intertestamental period, as we can read about them, how did they interpret these things? Not that they're absolutely correct, but that will be a start as to understanding this. Now, some say, well, I don't know that that's necessary in order to know what I'm to do. Did I need to know about the culture of that day? Well, let me give you another example. When the New Testament says, and it says it four times, four commands, same command four times, greet one another with a holy kiss. Who did that this morning? Did you? Did I? Well, are we in violation of a direct command? Four times in the New Testament. He said, well, no, preacher, don't you understand that to them, the holy kiss was a part of their culture? If that's a part of that Mediterranean culture, if you've ever been to Italy, folks, or those other Mediterranean, I remember when I was met at the airport by the Carrozzas. First, Elisabetta kissed me, and then Alessandro kissed me, and then as I journeyed, all the brethren, they were kissing me on both cheeks, and that's a part of that Mediterranean culture. Well, do we have practices in our culture that convey the same thing that the holy kiss was intended to convey? Yes. Call it the holy handshake, or the holy hug, or the holy greeting. You see my point? If we're to understand some of the Bible, we need to go back and understand to the degree we can what were the customs then and how did they understand it. All right, well, with that in mind, let's look at that. Is Bible wine the same as wine today? In other words, are we comparing apples with apples when we read wine in the Bible and we read? I'll tell you, I went to the grocery store yesterday, and I don't know that's the first time I've ever been there, but it hadn't been often. I went into the wine section. I wanted to look at the labels for this lesson, did a little research. So if you saw me in the liquor department of Randall's, and yes, I've opened the case and pulled down a can of beer, and I read that label too. Okay, that's what I was doing, okay? Everybody buy that? Are we comparing apples with apples? Secondly, if they are different and we think they are the same, will we make bad decisions? Of course we will. Look at this. Wine mixed with water in the New Testament was the common table drink. Before this study, I don't know that I really understood that. Now, for those of you that comes as a marvelous blessing, just hold on. We're not done. Now, what I'm going to show you is the research that I've done in the culture. And in doing this, what we're doing, we're looking at scholars, some of which have devoted their whole life to studying this time of history so that they can understand what are the practices and culture of that day. Some of them will talk about what the Jews practiced, what the Greeks practiced. Some of them, this first one, will talk about what was practiced during the time right after the New Testament, from the days of Jesus up until the 7th century. No, it's not biblical quotations, but I'll get to that in just a moment. All right, let's begin. From the Encyclopedia of Early Christianity, second edition, this article by Everett Ferguson, who is a scholar. I knew him when I was at Abilene Christian College. He is considered, if not the most eminent authority, one of them, on this period of biblical history. And he has edited this big encyclopedia from scholars all over submitting their research in all types of cultural issues. All right, let's look at wine. See what he says. The Greek oinos, and that is the common word for wine in the New Testament, and the Latin vinum, words for wine, although they could be used for the juice of the grape, underscore there, they could be. That's another lesson. They could be, however preserved or for the firm, however preserved or for the fermented juice of other fruits like dates, figs, primarily meant fermented grape juice. The ordinary table beverage of the Mediterranean world was a mixture of wine and water. Hang on to that idea. The proportions varied according to the period and purpose. Popular combinations involved 2 to 3 parts of water and 1 part of wine. Plutarch mentions that 3 parts of water to 1 of wine was suitable for grave magistrates sitting in the council hall. You get the point? We're diluting the wine as much as 3 to 1. Some say even 5 to 1. 2 parts to 1 left a person neither fully sober nor altogether witless. So you're in kind of that buzz zone. You think that's the place where Christians ought to be? In the buzz zone, not fully sober, but not altogether witless. Well, that's 2 parts to 1. And 3 parts to 2 caused a man to sleep peaceably and forget all cares. Half and half are unmixed wine in quantity brought on drunkenness or collapse. The Jews adopted the Greek and Roman practice of mixing water and wine. I'm going to give you a quote from the intertestamental period, 2 Maccabees 15:39. And rabbinic literature speaks of the ratios of 2 or 3 parts of water to 1 of wine. So you see, in these drinks, the predominant component was water, not wine. For just as it, this is from Maccabees, for just as it is harmful to drink wine alone, or again, to drink water alone, we can understand both. While wine mixed with water is sweet and delicious and enhances one's enjoyment, so also the style of the story delights the ears of those who read the work. In other words, he's comparing the wine and the water to his writing of this story. Now, 2 Maccabees comes in the intertestamental period before the New Testament. So it shows that there was Jewish thought, and you can go to a few other references, where this was done. This was accepted, practiced, common practice. Further, the mixed cup was part of the Passover meal. Now, one of the questions that I carried into my study was, and I've thought this all my life, I heard it preached, I guess, and I've heard other Christians say it. The wine at the Lord's Supper or at the Passover that Jesus used to institute the Lord's Supper had to be grape juice. Why? Because fermentation is a part of leaven in all leaven. I know many of you have heard that. I don't know that that can be supported. If so, I haven't found the evidence for it. Now I'm going to go visit a rabbi. I'm going to ask him. Get one who still believes in the Old Testament. There are a few around. But here, this, the mixed cup, there were 4 cups in the Passover celebration, that Jesus took one of them, was a mixed cup, and was expected by the Dead Sea Scrolls, that was written also in the intertestamental period, to be part of the eschatological, I can't even say it, Let me get back there and hit the button. The eschatological meal, I still didn't say it right. Yeah. The medicinal use of wine, as we know in Luke 10:34, that's the Good Samaritan. He had wine, poured it on his wounds, plus oil, was well known. And it was recognized that wine had a purifying effect on water. That's Paul to Timothy. Now, I want to look at another scholar. His name is Robert Stein. He wrote an article in Christianity Today back in the 70s. I've got a copy of it. By the way, if you want copies of any of these documents, you just ask me for them. I'll be giving them to you. Or where you can find them on the internet. Wine drinking in New Testament times. Now let's look at this wine to water ratios that they have discovered. Sometimes the ratio goes down to 1 to 1 and even lower. But it should be noted that such a mixture is referred to as, note it, strong wine. Drinking wine unmixed, on the other hand, was looked upon as Scythian or barbarian custom. In other words, the lowest of the low. They have no couth. They have no sobriety. It is evident that wine was seen in ancient times as a medicine and a solvent for medicines, and of course as a beverage. Yet as a beverage, it was always thought of as a mixed drink. Plutarch, for instance, states, "We call a mixture wine, although the larger of the component parts is water." The ratio of water might vary, but only barbarians drank it unmixed. And a mixture of wine and water of equal parts was seen as what? Strong drink and frowned upon. A no-no. Too strong. Too susceptible to inebriation. That's something you want to do. This is in the culture now. I'm not talking about, we're just talking about in the culture as far as we can see. The term wine or oinos in the ancient world then did not mean wine as we understand it today, but wine mixed with water. Usually a writer simply referred to the mixture of water and wine as wine, that's just the way it was regarded, to indicate that the beverage was not a mixture of water and wine, he would say, unmixed. And here's the Greek word for it, unmixed wine. When we come to the New Testament, this is key. When we come to the New Testament, the content of the wine is never discussed. Okay, preacher, if it's never discussed, how do you know that that was its constituent parts in the New Testament? Consider the next statement. The burden of proof, however, is surely upon anyone who would say that the wine of the New Testament is substantially different from the wine mentioned by the Greeks, the Jews during the intertestamental period, and the early church fathers. What's the evidence that they would have said, no, that's not the wine we're going to have? Now today, wines and beers today. And by ABV, we mean alcohol by volume. Wines today, 10 to 15% alcohol by volume. Fortified wines can go up to 20% alcohol by volume. Beers, 3 and some few go up to size 10. The majority of them are in the 5-6 range percent of alcohol by volume. Spirits, these are distilled spirits, start at around 30% and go as high as 99. Note, the Bible never speaks of distilled spirits. Why? Too early. They weren't invented till hundreds of years later by the Arabs. Ancients did not distill their spirits. That method had not been invented. So we're not talking about super, super, super potent liquids. all currently in our culture unmixed. Do you know of any manufacturer of their spirits who water it down 5-1, 3-1? All are unmixed. By biblical terminology of the day, that qualifies as a strong drink. They're unmixed. Wines in the New Testament, what are they like? Wines, 4-6%. This is the range. The percentage of alcohol by volume is regulated by the amount of sugar in the grape. And the ones I've read indicated that the grapes of that region could produce 4-6% on average alcoholic content by volume. They were mixed with water. Most often 2-5 parts of water to every one part of wine. Now look what you're going to do with the percentage when you do that. You're going to get a drink that in many cases, not even 1% alcohol by volume. See the difference? In other words, an extremely small amount of alcohol by volume, by normal practice. The maximum amount of alcohol that can be produced in a grape is 14%. But you gotta have a special grape that's got a lot of sugar in it. It's as high as it will go. Even if you take the worst case scenario or the best case scenario, depending on your view, 14%, and you cut it 5 times. Conclusion. Bible wine is not the same as wine today. That's the conclusion I have to draw from my study. It took a lot to make one drunk or in any way affect his mind. And I believe this explains why drunkenness is pictured as excessive drinking. This helps us to understand the regulation of an elder is not given to much wine or to wine. You got to be given to it of this Bible wine to produce any level of inebriation. Stein remarks that one's drinking would probably affect the bladder long before the mind. And I believe it helps to explain why wine could be praised and described as a blessing because of its inability when watered down, to easily affect the mind. Thank you for listening this morning. Now, I want to say that if you have questions or comments, feel free to make them. I'll hold myself open after the assembly to stay as long as you'd like and as you can. And tonight, if you want to think about it and come back with questions, you know, put me on the hot seat if you see elements of my presentation that just cannot sustain or be sustained by careful inquiry. Feel free to do that. I mean, I welcome it. I'll be happy to share with you all the resources that I've been trying to read. I'll tell you, I've been working on this and I apologize to all of you that I indicated I'd have this done before now. But I just had to keep working until I got comfortable that I believed I knew what the facts were. These are the facts as far as I know them. But I've already told you, when I learn different, then I'll just say I was wrong. There are other facts, and we're not done. There are other ways of looking at this issue, and we'll consider those in another time. Thank you for being so patient today. I hope it helps. I want these to be helpful to you. If you'd like to obey the gospel, please come. Let's stand. Let us sing.